Lucky Strike is out in cinemas on Friday, the 17th of July. Inspired by true events, Lucky Strike tells the story of one soldier trapped behind enemy lines during the last major German offensive during World War II, what would become known as the Battle of the Bulge. Armed only with his Motorola SCR300 radio, a new technology, only battle-ready near the end of the war, he must use his wits and spycraft to thwart the advancing Nazi panzer army and find his way back home. Starring Scott Eastwood, Taylor John Smith, Colin Hanks, and ingenue Ellis Taylor, Lucky Strike is out in cinemas now. In 1980s South Africa, a well-known resident of a small town in the Northern Cape launched a scheme that many believed would be their ticket to the soft life. But it wouldn't be long before people outside of the scheme started to ask questions. When they did, they were shut down, even threatened by those within the scheme's quarters. But soon, the sheer scale of the fraud was laid bare. And it wasn't just contained to South Africa, with this scheme becoming the biggest postal fraud case in the United States history at the time. Nor would the man at the helm even contain his suspicious dealings to just this scheme. In many ways, it was just the beginning. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 206, The Rotten Milk Scam. As you well know by now, I occasionally like to delve into forms of crime that don't involve violence. It's an opportunity to explore other forms of criminality, and also to highlight just how much victims of financial scams suffer, with some of these schemes ending in complete financial ruin for people who have already retired and have no way of making their money back. And in the most severe outcomes, victims feeling overwhelmingly hopeless about their futures and sometimes taking their own lives. I think many of us still have this idea about financial crimes, especially Ponzi and pyramid schemes, that they're almost victimless or somehow less severe than other forms of crime. And by the same token, the perpetrators of these schemes aren't seen as dangerous criminals. Interestingly, though, with a few of these types of cases under my belt now, I've started to notice that sometimes these financial scammers are almost just as unrehabilitatable as sex offenders. Very often, they've never done anything to earn money outside of scamming or committing fraud. And even when they're caught and spend some time in prison, the lesson never really seems to land, that this is not the way to earn a living. In the most severe cases, sometimes confidence scammers escalate into violent offending, as was the case with Thabo Bester. But even when things don't get to that extent, as we'll discover in this case, there may well be individuals who simply cannot stop skating on that very thin line between honesty and deceit. In researching today's case, I used several online resources, a chapter from the book Buddha Phineacus by Isaac Smith, and the largest number of court judgment documents I have ever found relating to one single individual I've covered on this podcast. 5 different cases and judgments over the years. And that probably gives you a hint of what you're in for here. So let's get into episode 206, The Rotten Milk Scam.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information in our show notes.
I guess it's only fair to say at the outset that I'll be telling you a lot about what one specific individual, Adrian Nivot, has done and is alleged to have done over pretty much his entire life. In terms of criminality, I'll tell you exactly where Nivot has been convicted of something and where he hasn't. And in the latter cases, where the schemes he was involved in were officially declared illegal. And you can take from that what you will. Adrian Nivot would have been born in the mid to late 1940s. And he was born in an area which would go on to live and deliver many of his schemes. Nivot was well known in the Namaqualand, and many described him as charming and very easy to get along with. Adrian didn't finish matric, although he would later tell a journalist that he'd made a good stab at grade 11. Adrian Nivot really is a lifelong entrepreneur of sorts. One of his first business ventures was with his first wife. They travelled along the coast, catching crayfish and selling them out of their car. They'd made a decent income out of that until he'd been banned from doing so by local authorities. His time in the sea had given him another idea, though. And soon, he was harvesting sea bamboo, a large species of kelp from the shoreline. Nivot said that he'd read about how beauty products could be made out of kelp, and he and his wife started experimenting. Nivot was given a license to harvest the kelp, but this was soon cancelled. He claimed that it was because someone else that had been involved had been dishonest. As I tell you more about the other ventures Adrian Nivot was involved with, you'll likely start to see the same trend that I did. While it's not unusual for a serial entrepreneur to have lots of businesses that don't work out until one strikes it big, all of the ventures Nivot got into had two things in common. They seemed to just skate on that edge of legal versus illegal. And when they didn't work out, it was never, ever his fault. According to him, at least. After the kelp beauty product venture went south, Nivot called on his contacts in the Namaqualand and started a livestock transportation business, moving farmers' sheep from the Namaqualand to Cape Town. Simultaneously, he was exporting crushed crayfish shells to Germany, where they would be processed as protein sources for animal feed. These ventures seemed to bumble along for a while, until 1984, when Nivot had a new idea. It harkened back to his kelp beauty products business, but the legend he created as a backstory was much more endearing and a little exotic. As Nivot tells it, he'd been admiring the beautiful skin of one of the older women in his family. Sources jump between whether it was his grandmother or his aunt, and he'd wondered what her secret was. Then, he said, he'd started thinking about the story of Cleopatra and how she would bathe in milk to retain her beauty. So, he said, he started thinking about the power of milk as a beauty product, particularly in a sour form. And that led him to a brilliant idea. Now, I will say that currently there's very little real data to show that milk or cultured dairy of any kind has any long-lasting benefits for the skin. Of course, this was back in the 80s, so that has to be considered. And the other thing is that that story about Cleopatra is actually not what it seems. According to several historians, it was in fact not Cleopatra who had used milk products in her beauty regime, but rather a Roman empress, and she actually used sour donkey's milk as a facial. The idea of milk baths and linking that to Cleopatra was actually popularized by Hollywood in the 1960s movie Carry On Cleo, and the false link just stuck. Anyway, the story of Cleopatra and her alleged milk baths became central to the venture that Nivert soon started. It would even appear on the marketing material moving forward. The venture started relatively small, really just as something that the locals of Gharies in the Northern Cape, where Nivert lived, got into. But it quickly exploded across the country. The venture was called Cubus, and the premise was as follows. Nivert claimed to be developing a skincare range which was already in great demand across the world and would make a lot of money. The main ingredient in this range was a byproduct of what was essentially rotten milk. And Nivert said he needed a lot of this stuff if he was going to meet the demands of the beauty product line in development. So instead of trying to ferment a huge amount of milk himself, he reached out to his community to get in on the venture. Those who were interested needed to buy an activator from him for 30 rand. The investor would then take that activator and place it into a glass of milk, which would then ferment the milk and create globules of fermentation floating on the top of the liquid. This would then be removed, dried out, and posted back to Cubus in an envelope. For every envelope of dried product an investor sent back, they would earn 10 rand. Every investor could only send in one envelope a week, but the initial activator investment would continue to pay off, as they could use it over and over to activate more milk. So if they sent in one envelope a week, investors would pay off their initial investment in 3 weeks, and everything after that would be profit. Now, if these amounts seem really low, I will remind you that this was in the 1980s, and in today's money, you're looking at about 32 times that in value, so about 320 rand a week. Honestly, not bad money for popping powder into a glass of milk and walking away. And of course, the promise remained that once the beauty product started selling internationally, this would become an ongoing and lucrative business. It didn't take long for the lure of easy money to bring thousands of investors to Cubus's doors, often quite literally. Some people even landed light aircraft at Gharies to purchase large amounts of activator. At one point, there was a queue of people almost a kilometre long outside Cubus's offices. Nivert would later say, quote, "At one stage, we packed money into cardboard boxes and took it to the bank in my Datsun Bucky to pay it in," end quote. And although you might think that this surely must be an exaggeration, it really wasn't. Once the media got hold of the story and the Heiskanoot magazine published a story, Nivert and his Cubus venture became an almost overnight sensation. By the end of June 1984, Cubus Cultures had 20 million rand in its bank account at Barclays Bank in Bellville. By September that year, that amount had tripled. But then, something else happened in September 1984. On the heels of the press coverage Cubus had received, a few investigative journalists had started to, well, smell something a little off. Journalists from Rapport newspaper started to question exactly when and how these beauty products were going to be made. And allegations were made that there actually was no beauty product line, and there never had been. The journalist's expose revealed the following about Cubus. Essentially, the Cubus venture up until that point, the journalist had proffered, was nothing more than a chain letter operation. Huge amounts of money had been exchanging hands, with the people of Khariz alone earning up to 1 million rand a month from Cubas. But there was nothing behind the money. The inflated amounts being paid to the growers, as the investors were now being called, couldn't actually be supported by any real economic value in the business. This in itself is problematic. But the journalist further revealed that those initial high payouts were never meant to last. Adrian had admitted that, quote, "We deliberately paid the growers so much to create a sensation. The whole of life is just a gimmick." End quote. The plan was that in the months to come, investors would be paid much less for the powder they sent in, and it emerged there was really nothing in writing that could stop Nivote from doing that. There had never been any promise that the current payouts level would continue, and he could actually pay as much or as little as he wanted, and he could change the payout amount overnight without any notice. He even said that he might decide, if it suited him, to grow his own cultures and not use the investors anymore at all. The only stipulation in writing had been that the investors would be paid not less than 100% of the production cost. And that cost was not detailed anywhere. By some calculations, growers could have ended up being paid just a few cents for their product. It was becoming clear that Cubas was not what it purported to be. And two more revelations would call the entire venture into major question. The first was when the journalists paid a surprise visit to the Cubas factory in Paro in the Western Cape. There, instead of finding a laboratory-like condition in which the Holy Grail activator was being made to be sent out to eager growers, and the incoming powder product was being decanted and prepared for use in expensive beauty products, the journalists in fact found a large electric mill. The mill was continuously running, and being fed into it were the envelopes that the growers had so carefully prepared and shipped off to Cubas. The envelopes, filled with powder, were being ground up. Paper, glue and all, into a fine powder on the other end. Then that powder was being repackaged as, you probably guessed it, the activator, and being sold to unsuspecting new investors for 30 rand, who would carefully place the magic powder, which was really just ground up rotten milk, envelope paper and glue, into their glasses of milk, to start the process all over again. On the financial end of this, something else was becoming clear. If there was actually no product and the growers themselves were essentially the product, this was not only unsustainable, but also new investors were actually being paid with old investors' money. And that verges very steeply on the definition of a Ponzi scheme. As with other Ponzi schemes I've covered on this podcast, the house of cards starts to tumble when the number of new investors reduces and the amounts that the old investors need to be paid outstrips the new money coming in. It was clear that at the rates Cubas had grown, with no real product being produced, this moment would likely come sooner rather than later. This was likely why Nivote had the failsafe of being able to reduce what he paid growers at any time, to extend that point of the card house tumble. But it would emerge that he'd taken other steps to secure himself too. Without any public announcement, Nivote had sold 70% of his stake in Cubas to a company called Equity Bancorp International South Africa. Quite early on when this was discovered, many suspected that two brothers with a history of known scams were involved in this leg of the deal. The brothers, Gert and Vlugh Theron, denied any involvement. But when journalists started digging a little into the directorship of Equity Bancorp, it was discovered that the Theron brothers were indeed linked to the company, and the chairman of the company was based in California in the United States. Cubis was going international. A huge number of other corporations had started popping up around Cubis during this time too, all with links or shares, and for the most part, all run by individuals whose names had been regularly linked to suspicious and often blatantly fraudulent activity. Adrian Nivot denied all of the allegations against him and Cubis. He denied that it had all been a gimmick and called Cubis a good business, which was on the verge of beginning manufacturing and exporting. But no one could find any evidence of this, and investors began to worry. Nivot was inundated with calls from investors, and new investments in the scheme, which had already begun to subside sharply, fell. But this was not Nivot's only problem at this time. He had made a great deal of money from Cubis in a very short time, in 1984. But it had emerged that since at least 1981, he'd also been involved in another venture. This came to light when he was arrested and charged with illegal diamond dealing. The case in question had been ongoing for some time, and four other participants in the diamond scheme had already been convicted and sent to prison. The scheme was less a scheme and more outright theft, as the diamonds had quite literally been stolen from a mine in Namibia and then pushed into the black market in South Africa for sale. The diamond case would take quite a long time to come to trial and for a verdict to be finalised. And in the meantime, Nivot was scrambling to save Cubis. Some of the top actuaries in the country estimated that the rapport's exposé, which had essentially hastened the demise of the Cubis scheme, had saved potential and existing growers about 60 million rand in losses. It became clear how important it was for Cubis to either become a viable business or cease operations immediately, because every day that it operated just brought more investors into the scheme. By the 30th of November 1984, it was estimated that in order to conclude the scheme, Nivot would need 810 million rand to pay the more than 10,000 existing growers for their harvests. And analysis of Cubis's assets showed that this was simply not possible. The Ponzi-like exchange had reached its crescendo. Adrian's legal team advised him that he needed to urgently make a decision and either find a real economic output for Cubis so that it became a functional business or end operations immediately. While investors around the country were in an uproar, a very interesting dynamic played out in Nivot's hometown of Gariz. The Cubis scheme had probably been the biggest cash injection into the area in a very long while, and undoubtedly, also because the man at the helm was a local, residents found it difficult to come to terms with the idea that the scheme was not a viable business, and they'd in fact been had. Their state of denial was so intense that when journalists descended on the town to report further, their lives and safety were threatened. Residents felt that if the journalists hadn't reported on the scheme, it would have continued undeterred, and it was the journalists' fault that they'd had this opportunity taken away from them. Of course, finding yourself involved in something like this is a difficult emotional journey, and no one wants to admit that they've been fleeced. So it might feel easier for some to lay the blame at the journalist's door rather than acknowledge that their fellow residents may not have been totally on the level with them. and they'd not really dug very deep to figure out what they were buying into either. This feeling was probably further supported when Nivot and some of his fellow large investors in the scheme took Rapport to court, claiming damages of 4 million rand. I could not find any further information about what happened with this case, and considering what happened next, I would find it highly unlikely that a court would have found any form of defamation had taken place. As I mentioned at the start, Odeon Nivot's name appears in 5 different court judgments online, and none of them are related to any action against Rapport. When authorities started to take action against Cubis, however, few could deny that there had to be something fishy about the scheme. It's important to note at this point that laws around Ponzi and pyramid schemes had not really been formalized. You'll even hear later when we discuss the international consequences of this case that there weren't many legal avenues that even the United States had in place around such schemes at the time, and this case would become a legal precedent of sorts there too. In South Africa, the action taken at the time amounted to the announcement of a police investigation, and the Reserve Bank refused to approve any overseas payments to or from Cubis in South Africa to prevent the financial situation with Cubis becoming even more complex for investigators. Nivot continued to do his best to save his venture. He flew his wife and daughter to Johannesburg for discussions with cosmetics manufacturers and held a high-profile launch event, which he alleged was to launch the cosmetics side of the business, and at which a Porsche 911 Carrera was given away. Certain members of the press were invited, and it was very clearly a public relations move. In addition, photographs were circulated to the press of Nivot's posing with cargo containers, which allegedly contained Cubis product being shipped overseas. When journalists did a bit of digging into manifests, though, it became clear that none of the containers had any cosmetic products or raw material in them, and instead they contained clothing, spare car parts, and wine, which was headed no further than Johannesburg. Despite these PR events, the reality of the situation began to hit home with the growers when they were advised that their 10 rand per envelope payments would be reduced to 1 rand with immediate effect. And they were further informed that by the end of 1984, they could expect to be earning no more than 50 cents per envelope. What actually happened was that by December 1984, Rapport announced that Cubis was no more. Adrian Nivot had been instructed to cease all operations around Cubis immediately. His assets were frozen, and the matter was referred to court for adjudication. In February 1985, the court ruled as follows. Quote, "The company merely made use of the delivered dry product by grinding it finely, envelopes and all, and reselling it as activators to new growers or to existing growers wishing to expand their participation in the scheme. It was useful for nothing else. Consequently, it is clear that the scheme could be kept going only for as long as the company managed to keep acquiring more and more new growers to whom activators could be sold, because it was only from the proceeds of such ever-increasing sales that the company could stay ahead in paying growers who delivered dry product to the company. On this basis, it is common cause between the parties in the present proceedings that the scheme constituted an unlawful lottery, as contemplated in Section 2(1) of the Gambling Act 51 of 1965, read with the relevant definitions in Section 1 of the Act. It follows that the participants in the scheme, the company and the growers, made themselves guilty of offences under the Act, provided the requisite mens rea was present in their case." End quote. As is always the case with Ponzi or pyramid-type schemes, The investigation process follows two legs. One is to determine where the money has gone within the scheme. And because it is now an illegal scheme, to get back as much of those illegal profits as possible. And the other is on the side of the people involved in the scheme. Not the masterminds in this leg, mind you, but the growers or investors themselves. Because as unfair as it sounds, whether they knew it or not, some benefited financially from an illegal operation, and they were therefore not allowed to keep that profit. The key in wrapping up is to return all participants to the status quo as before the scheme started. So no one should experience a profit or loss beyond what they came into the scheme with. Those who profited should have had those profits seized, and those profits should be used to pay back those who had lost money, and any other individuals or companies who may have provided a service and not been paid, and the like. It's one of the very rare situations where victims are also, for most intents and purposes by law, also the criminals. In the vast majority of Ponzi or pyramid schemes, those who have lost money do not get it back, or at least not most of it, because the cost of investigation and what SARS wants as their chunk ends up eating away at most of what is recovered. Also, individuals who start schemes like this, in general, know very well that it's not going to continue forever, and they are very good at squirreling away money and putting it into assets and other people's names, and even overseas, so that it can't be found or seized. Adrian Nivot walked away from the Cubis saga with no criminal charges against him, and 2 million rand of his estate was returned to him. Many of the growers had said they didn't want their money back, and despite Adrian reportedly having gone into the scheme with 750 rand in his bank account, he still came out pretty financially stable. But even though Cubis was officially tanked in South Africa, it was really just getting started in other parts of the world. Even though American authorities had said quite early on that they would not allow the Cuba scheme to operate in their country, it had indeed made its way there, under the leadership of predominantly Gert and Fluch Theron. In the United States, the scheme was sold under the name BC40, and it had become just as popular there as it had been in South Africa, and equally quickly. As soon as news began to trickle through that Cubis had officially been declared illegal in South Africa, the US authorities decided to take a stand. Police began investigating there, and the Attorney General of Kansas warned the public that the scheme was a scam and they should not partake. Interestingly, in the US, as in South Africa, farming communities were heavily targeted for the scheme. Warrants of arrest were issued for both Gert and Fluch Theron. Gert was arrested, but Fluch went on the run. The two brothers, who were the sons of a humble station master from the Swartland, found themselves standing accused as the masterminds of what was the biggest postal fraud scheme in American history at that time. Within 6 months, it was alleged that the Theron brothers had managed to fleece thousands of US citizens out of 250 million rand. Again, please keep in mind that this is 1985 money, and that's a massive amount today, so it was obscenely large at that time in history. The brothers had allegedly been living so large that Fluch had managed to ingratiate himself into some of the top-tier celebrity circles and married a very wealthy woman whose family were connected to the Kennedys and Liberace. This access to money and influence did not bode well for securing Fluch for trial, as he remained on the run although he had contacted police and claimed that he would hand himself over when he was ready. At the same time, South African authorities were requesting the extradition of the brothers, as they wanted them to answer for their involvement in Cubis in our country. But US authorities were set on getting their justice first, as this would undoubtedly be precedent-setting, and they couldn't let it slide. Fluch wasn't the only one who had managed to bag himself the affections of a wealthy woman. Gert, despite being married with children, had a wealthy lady friend who attended every single one of his court hearings, and even offered her brand new Cadillac as part of his bail deal. Fluch spent a lot of time promising authorities he'd hand himself over, and never actually doing so. Eventually, though, both he and his brother were sentenced for the roles they played in the American wing of the Cubis scheme. With laws not really being developed enough around financial crimes to offer any real criminal sanction, both brothers served no more than 2 years each in prison before being released. Besides its links to the US, Cubis also made it to the United Kingdom, where a man attempted to start a leg of the scheme in Wales. This didn't seem to take off as well there as it did elsewhere. Maybe because it's colder there, and the milk takes longer to go off. Kidding. I'm kidding. In addition to that, there were links to a company that claimed to be Swiss-owned, but it was in fact formed in Liechtenstein, and investigators found that the individuals running that leg of Cubis had links to organized crime. It's actually astounding if you think about the scale of how this very strange idea, born in the Namaqualand, spread like wildfire across the globe. Just when authorities thought they'd put out all the fires, another little ember would start burning elsewhere. Back in South Africa, Adrian Nivot expressed his unhappiness at how he had been treated. He felt that the state had tried to make an example out of him, and all the actions taken had been completely unnecessary. I am sure that he would have at least been grateful that he'd been left with a sizable chunk of change, though, because that diamond case was still on the go. By the time Cubis had been shut down, the diamond case had seen more than 150 days in total of court sittings. Nivot had racked up 600,000 rand in legal costs. But in 1990, he was finally found guilty and sentenced to 8 years incarceration for illegal diamond sales. He would end up only serving a year of that before he was released on parole. Nivot maintained that he had never had anything to do with stolen diamonds and that Cubis was never a fraudulent scheme. He referred to himself in one interview as an honest crook, which by his explanation meant that he was able to come up with ideas that other people wouldn't think about, but that were not illegal, just different from the norm. Of course, the South African justice system had disagreed. Although he would, to his alleged upset, forever be known as the rotten milk guy, Adrian Nivot did continue his entrepreneurship after being released from prison. There was a carbon credits project to electrify rural areas with clean energy, which didn't get off the ground. He also had a plan to create the, quote, largest holiday city in the world along the Orange River near Pofara. It would include a luxury hotel and a gambling complex, a landing strip for passenger planes, and he opened up for investments in what he called the Las Vegas in the Kalahari project. He managed to raise about 5 million rand before the Minister of Trade and Industry forced him to give it all back to the investors. Nivot eventually managed to get his family's farm back, which had been seized, and From there, he would try a few other ventures. Over the years, Nivotas continued to make the news. In 2004, he announced that he had started a new venture called Kybus. Adrian said that he discovered that his farm contained an almost inexhaustible supply of a substance called kaolin. Kaolin, also called China clay, is a soft, earthy, and usually white natural clay, primarily composed of the mineral kaolinite. It is formed by the weathering of aluminous minerals like feldspar and is widely used in ceramics, paper, paints, rubber, cosmetics, and pharmaceuticals due to its chemical inertness and bright, non-abrasive texture. Adrian estimated that he would need about 3 billion rand to mine the kaolin on his land. And while he could have set up a public company and taken investments, he decided that that would be too expensive. And so instead, he decided to go a familiar route. Kybus, not to be mistaken for Cubus, of course, would run as follows. Adrian had set up the Kybus Association, and he invited people to register as members. The members had to provide their ID numbers and other personal information, such as their addresses. In an almost loyalty club-like setup, every member would receive 10 points on registration. And the more information they provided, the more points they were awarded. So they were essentially selling their personal information, except not for money. Not immediately, of course. Members could earn the most points by referring other members to the association. That sounds a lot like a pyramid scheme to me. Registration cost members 50 rand, and that money would be used for administration and other expenses, according to Nivot. When the association had enough members, he said that they would then form a company, and every member could exchange their points for shares in the kaolin mining operation. Whether or not its name and those associations played a role in the second iteration of a familiar scheme, Kybus did not get off the ground, and mining never started on the land. 4 years later, news reports mentioned Nivot again, saying that he had sadly been diagnosed with cancer. But the following year, after receiving treatment, he announced that he was cancer-free and on the mend. In 2014, a rather interesting reunion took place in which Nivot agreed to be interviewed by the original journalist who had broken the story about Cubus in 1984, on the 30th anniversary of the scheme's rise and fall. He told the journalist that he'd written a book called Naive or Mistaken, which he planned to publish at some point. He also said that when he died, he wanted his gravestone to read, "Here lies an honest crook." But that gravestone was not in Adrian Nivot's near future, and he still had a venture or two in his pocket. It would later emerge that when Nivot was giving this anniversary interview, he likely already had his newest venture in his sights. From court documents, we know that in 2016, Nivot formed a public company. Also, according to the exact wording from court documents, the purpose of that company was to facilitate the creation of a, quote, whites-only settlement called Eureka on a farm near Harries in the Northern Cape, end quote. The farm in question belonged to Adrian Nivot. It was the same piece of land he'd previously wanted to mine for kaolin. The way the deal worked was that shareholders would buy shares from the company, which would entitle them to erect dwellings on the farm. Nivot described the settlements he had envisioned as a security estate, and shares were sold through what he referred to as the dealing room, and shares were sold under strict criteria. In later court cases surrounding this development, investors would say that the criteria included the shareholders having to be a white person, which is why the court was able to safely say that the intention had been for this to be a whites-only development. That premise alone was alarming enough. But that wasn't what ended up collapsing the Nevote venture. What are we on now? 5.0? 6.0? From when Adrian started marketing the venture in 2016 until ground started being broken in 2018 or 2019, everything seemed to be going swimmingly. There was interest, and people were buying shares so that they could build houses in Eureka. But once structures started being erected, problems arose with the local municipality. Participants in the scheme would later say that they had been given the impression that the company Nevote had formed would handle all of the administrative side of things because he owned the land, and all they had to do was pay for their shares and build their homes. But then the building inspector started visiting, and it turned out that none of the buildings on Eureka had been approved. They were illegal structures. The local municipality started to take legal action to have the homes torn down. This back and forth would take another 2 years. By 2021, the Eureka development housed 36 families who had all bought shares and built homes on the land. And when those families started to get notices that the municipality was taking court action to tear their houses down, they looked to the man at the helm, Adrian Nevote, for answers. But they would soon discover that he actually wasn't legally at the helm anymore. Nevote had stepped down as director of Eureka in 2019, probably around the time the municipality came knocking. Before resigning as a director, a court would later find that he had laid claim to an ongoing shareholding of at least 60% in Eureka. And the agreement gave him the unilateral right to increase that percentage in future, in return for his intellectual property in matters such as building sewage systems, houses and roads, and desalinating groundwater. The resignation agreement also gave Nevote the right to dispose of his shares to whomever he chose, and he was not obligated to offer any of them to existing shareholders first. It soon became clear to the Eureka residents that they were pretty much on their own in the legal battle with the municipality, and they stood to lose their homes and, to some extent, their investment entirely, because even if they got their plans approved, the land itself was only zoned for agricultural use, and therefore the development in itself was illegal. In South Africa, agricultural land typically allows for one main dwelling and one secondary dwelling as additional use rights, plus any accommodation needed for registered workers. The exact number depends on local municipal zoning and some other criteria, but the 38 families who had built on Eureka were most certainly not within the zoning allowance. Oh. And just as an aside, you also can't mine, say, kaolin on land that is zoned for agricultural use without having the correct zoning and permits approved first. Considering the story started in 1984, I guess it's probably one of the few cases I've covered that still continues, almost until this day. In 2022, one of the shareholders and residents of Eureka made an application for Eureka to be placed in provisional liquidation. This was approved, and in 2023, Cape Town Judge Patrick Gamble ruled that the company was operating illegally and placed it into the hands of the Master of the High Court. The judge further ruled that Eureka had made an unlawful initial public offering, Then it had diluted its shareholding through an unlawful secondary offering. In addition, he said that the trading room, which was used to sell shares, constituted an unlicensed securities exchange, and therefore, the share trades it had conducted were illegal. The judge ruled that although the values of the entity and those who had become shareholders stood in stark contrast to the values of our constitution, he could not confuse morality with legality. And although he may not agree with the choices of the parties involved, he could only make decisions through the letter of the law. And therefore, the entity was illegal, and all dealings with it had also been illegal. And on the other side of it, those who had bought shares in what they had thought was a legitimate venture should be offered the opportunity to get as much of their money back as possible. And placing the company into liquidation was the way to do that. In November 2023, the final order came through for Eureka to be liquidated. A journalist contacted Adrian Nivot for comment, and he would only say that bad press had once again scuppered a good venture, and although the judge claimed that his decision was fair and just, Adrian didn't feel it was fair and just for everyone. Which, you know, it's probably not going to feel fair and just for the guy who's doing the illegal stuff, Adrian. And I'm not sure that it should. I haven't found any current updates for the status of the Eureka liquidation. As at 2024, some investors were still in court trying to fight the local municipality to prevent their homes from being demolished. I've noticed quite a lot of coverage about Adrian Nivot and his various schemes on social media recently. I don't know what's behind that specifically, but I assume it has to do with ongoing issues related to Eureka. And Adrian himself pops up occasionally on posts and replies to people. He's still living in Cadiz and seemingly happy and healthy. But it's not his little comments that pop up that really stand out to me. What strikes me the most is the people who comment saying how many people they know who've lost money to various schemes with his name on them over the years. It's the people who are spitting mad that they were led down the garden path. And really, how when this person does respond to these messages, he does so with absolutely no remorse. He clearly still believes he's done absolutely nothing wrong. And yes, in many cases, he has not been legally charged with anything. But when you've had at least two businesses declared illegal operations, and those are just the two that got off the ground, and so many of the other business ventures followed the same formula, can you really shrug your shoulders and say, well, I didn't go to jail for it, so is it wrong? Because yes, it is. It is wrong to weaponize community and to tell half-truths and bold lies. And it's most certainly wrong to profit when others have lost as a result. I know lots of people who are serial entrepreneurs, who have tons of small business ventures that never take off or don't last or do, and they sell them and start again because that's just what they love doing. But this is not that. This is serial something, but it's not entrepreneurship. I think it's fair to say that many people will find it difficult to empathize with those who lost money in the Eureka scheme, because the intention behind this scheme was not one that the vast majority of South Africans share. And certainly, it isn't conducive to the type of country I want us to have. But it's a mentality that exists all the same, unfortunately. And in the same breath, I'll say that what happened was illegal, and the law should take its course. Perhaps it's a lesson to anyone with a similar way of thinking. That safety and trustworthiness is not built into the color of someone's skin. It's built into their humanity and their character. And if you think just because someone looks like you and speaks like you, they are automatically trustworthy, you may have a very painful and expensive wake-up call waiting for you. In general, individuals who scam victims in all kinds of Ponzi schemes never set out on the schemes with good intentions. The vast majority know exactly what they are doing and intend to cash in and get out as quickly as they can. And the people left with the real-world consequences are those who have invested in what looked like a sure thing because their friend did or their neighbor had. And the guy in charge could spin a yarn better than any podcaster. And it's those people who pay the real price. Long after the jokes about rotten milk are gone, or people forget the name of the latest crippled Ponzi scheme, it's the retired person who invested the bulk of their hard-earned pension, or the hard-working, ordinary individual who just wants to grow their savings for a child's wedding or the holiday they've never had, who watches it all get swept away in a second. And they are still there, after all the attention is gone, and their lives are still devastated, with little to no accountability for the person who pushed the buttons and pulled the strings. For more victim-focused true crime content, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcasts on social media platforms for updates on new episodes and other crime-related stuff. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. CCSA has partnered with the SA Criminologist platform. And if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za. And support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.